Pleasure to be talking to all of you today about some work I've been doing with Philip Schuster recently on massless particles and long-range forces. So I'll start with just a picture of a coffee mug. This is supposedly a CERN coffee mug. I think it summarizes nicely what is probably the most famous achievement of particle physics in the second half of the 20th century, namely understanding that a wide variety of observed natural phenomena, essentially all the fundamental phenomena in nature, could be understood through different phases of gauge theories. Sorry, is this mic on? I feel like I hear a little bit of reverb when I'm close to the podium. Okay, I'll let them sort it out. So, well, before I move any further, I think the most dramatic lasting impact of this same period of physics is actually not figuring out exactly how the forces work in nature, but realizing that this basic structure is essentially almost inevitable. What I mean by that is that at least in coffee mug form, where we've suppressed all the different indices of different gauge groups, different flavor sectors, the difference between different types of fermion in the standard model, it's a very simple theory, which is to say it's very simple in its structure. It's entirely dictated by a choice of gauge symmetries and a choice of low spin matter content that interacts consistently with those gauge symmetries. And it's that simple structure that I want to stress is, in a sense, almost inevitable. Now, the almost that I keep sticking into that sentence will be the main theme of this talk. But I want to first explain what I mean by saying that gauge symmetries and space-time geometry are inevitable, specifically inevitable consequences of quantum mechanics and relativity. The basic argument, as it was laid out by Weinberg, is that quantum mechanics tells us the essential objects that we should try to produce out of a physical theory are transition amplitudes. Transition amplitudes between some in-state and an out-state. And conservation of probability means that these amplitudes are unitary. This lets us constrain complicated amplitudes by relating them to simpler ones. Relativity, on the other hand, tells us something about the symmetry properties of the external states. Specifically, that we should think about states in terms of how they decompose under the Lorentz symmetry. And that leads us to think about states as involving some multiplicity of particles, each labeled by their momentum and spin. Relativity also tells us how the amplitude transforms under those Lorentz symmetries. The amplitude should transform the same way as the product of states. So far, this all seems very simple. But let's look at how it applies in a special case, and we'll see some interesting constraints emerging. If we consider an amplitude where a bunch of particles come in, they scatter, and one helicity one particle is emitted in the process, just the requirement that the amplitude should transform consistently with the Lorentz transformation of that final state involving a helicity one particle guarantees that the amplitude can be written in terms of a polarization tensor contracted into some vector function of momenta, and that vector has to be orthogonal to the momentum of the helicity one particle. Now, this last equation, k dot m equals zero, you may recognize as an Onshell-Ward identity in field theory. But we don't need to assume gauge invariance in order to derive that equation. It's just a result of demanding that the amplitude transform like one helicity one state, as well as, obviously, the transformations of all the other states. Now let's make one more simplifying assumption. Let's imagine that the helicity one particle is much lower in momentum than all the other particles involved in the scattering process. In that case, unitarity lets us simplify the allowed form of this amplitude considerably, because we know that emission off external legs should dominate. The reason it should dominate is that any time the helicity one particle is emitted off an initial or final state particle, the intermediate state is only off shell by the momentum of the photon. And since that's a small momentum, that means these correspond to nearly on shell intermediate states. And so the whole amplitude can be broken down into some overall prefactor, and then a sum over all the different initial and final state particles of that nearly on shell propagator times something called a soft factor, which just parametrizes roughly the amplitude for each particle to radiate off that helicity one particle. Now, when we put these together, it doesn't seem like they would tell you very much. But in fact, there's a unique solution, which is that the soft factor for radiating off helicity 1 off particle, off the jth particle, has to take a specific form. And not only that, that's just a constraint on the coupling of the helicity 1 particle to the matter from the fact that it transforms in a certain way. That's somehow not that surprising. But from this k dot m equals 0 condition, we also get a second constraint, that those coupling coefficients really are worthy of the name of a charge, because they have to be conserved in all interactions of the theory. In any theory where helicity 1 particles interact consistently with matter, all interactions of that matter have to have the same sum of charges in their incoming state as in the outcoming state. So just postulating helicity 1 interacting particles, quantum mechanics, and relativity, we're inevitably led to describing a theory of a degree of freedom like a photon that couples to a conserved charge, and a symmetry that the whole theory can be abelian or non-abelian associated with that conservation law. And from further consistency arguments, you can derive all the usual physical features that we associate with electromagnetism, that like charges repel, that there's electric and magnetic forces, and so forth. Now, if you apply the exact same argument to helicity 2, you'll find that the coupling doesn't just have to be conserved, but rather the helicity 2 particles have to couple to momentum. They have to do so in a universal way. So this gives us universally attractive gravitation. It also tells us, very simply, that in order for the coupling to be universal, well, that means that the helicity 2 graviton has to have a self-coupling. And from self-consistently trying to embed this in a larger theory, you find a geometric structure that's essentially that of general relativity. So this is, I think, a very remarkable success of a simple point of view, just considering quantum mechanics, relativity, and interactions of massless particles. And from that, we're inevitably led to the kinds of interactions that we see as long-range forces in nature. So a natural question to ask is what other kinds of forces would be allowed by these same principles? What happens, for example, if we look at helicity 3 or even higher helicities? And in the same work, Weinberg showed that actually there's no consistent Lorentz invariant interactions for helicity 3 and higher in the soft limit. So in other words, helicity 3 particles, even if they existed, could never interact strongly enough to mediate a long-range force. Now this, if it were the end of the story, would be, form a very compelling and tight explanation of why gauge theory and general relativity seem to be true in nature, because in fact, they seem to be the only ways that massless particles can interact, consistent with quantum mechanics and relativity. But this is not the end of the story. There is one other type of spin that a massless particle can possess. It's not talked about very often, but it's actually been known for about 75 years. Wigner called them continuous spin, but this is a fairly misleading label, because in the most physical way of talking about them, there's nothing continuous at all about the degrees of freedom. So I'll just call them CSPs to avoid that word continuous. And the physical way to think about them is a particle that has a tower of helicity states that it can take. Just like a spin 1/2 particle can be in the spin up or the spin down configuration, these have an infinite tower of possible states that they can take on. And all these states mix under Lorentz transformations. So this is clearly relevant to the question of whether gauge interactions in gravity are the inevitable consequences of massless spinning particle interactions. But it's not known yet whether there's a consistent theory for interacting CSPs. There's no theory known, on one hand. And on the other hand, there's no good counterargument. So if there's one thing you take away from this talk, I hope it's this, that there is a very basic, simple, open problem in long-distance physics that, as I'll show, will have testable consequences and that we still don't really understand the answer to. But I mentioned that there's no good counterargument, okay? And yet these haven't been considered very seriously for 75 years. So I don't say this lightly. In fact, there's a lot of potential countering arguments that could have stopped this possibility dead in its tracks, but just surprisingly turn out to work. So for example, we might think that since these have helicity 3, 4, in fact, infinitely high helicity states, the same Lorentz invariance and quantum mechanics arguments that exclude normal helicity 3 particles from interacting significantly would also constrain the interactions of these CSPs. In just simple amplitudes like single soft emission, we could rule them out in one short fell swoop. But no, there is actually a consistent amplitude, which I'll show you today, for CSP emission. It's almost unique as well, and that means that from that amplitude, we can derive all kinds of consequences for the physics of interacting CSPs, just like we can for the cases of helicity 1 and 2. The consistency with Lorentz invariance in quantum mechanics also seems to persist in multi-CSP amplitudes and in processes where a CSP is exchanged, giving rise to a force between matter particles. But you still might worry that there's some other problems associated with this infinite tower of states. It's not something we see very often, and it could obviously lead to some problems. For example, if you have infinitely many states, then in calculating the rate for any physical process, you're doing an infinite sum that has the potential to be divergent. Also, in thermodynamic equilibrium with an infinite number of states would seem likely to cause some problems. But it turns out that both of these problems are actually solved by Lorentz invariance. And finally, we might think, well, these particles seem incompatible with field theory. And there is what you might call a little bit of tension. In the same way that you can't write down interactions of a photon in terms of a local field that transforms covariantly, that really transforms like a single particle state. No, there's a gauge invariance that you need to build into the theory. That's true here as well, but with a gauge invariance, we can write down an action that's local in terms of fields and consistently couple it to currents. So these are a lot of partial results, but a lot of partial results that suggest that actually these CSPs do have the potential to be the sort of building blocks of a consistent theory. The question, of course, is what would such a theory look like? And what's most intriguing of all is precisely how the amplitudes that I mentioned right at the very top behave at high energies. So although a CSP has an infinite tower of states, it's very important to recognize that Lorentz invariance relates their amplitudes. It doesn't force them all to be equal. And so the relationship is precisely that at high energies, the amplitudes simplify dramatically. In fact, the consistent interactions can be classified into three types, differing in their high energy behavior. In one type, the high energy limit of the interactions looks like a scalar. In another, it looks like a gauge boson. And in another, it looks like a helicity 2 graviton. So this, of course, raises an interesting question. Is it possible that all the long-range phenomena that we've seen, electromagnetism, gravitation, can be explained consistently, not in terms of different types of helicities, but in terms of one type of degree of freedom, a CSP, with different types of interactions giving rise to very different phenomena. Just like different regimes of gauge theories give rise to very different phenomena, depending on whether they're gauged or confined in the Coulomb phase. So what'll I do in this talk? Well, I first want to argue that actually, if we generalize spin to relativistic theories, consider spin for massless particles from first principles, the most generic possibility is actually the CSP. That our familiar helicity representations that we all know and love are really a special case, fairly degenerate one. So after explaining that kinematics, I'll look at the possibility of consistent interactions, starting from this kind of soft emission argument along the lines of the ones inspired by Weinberg for helicity 1 and 2. And this will show us our first example of how CSP interactions can approach scalar interactions at high energies. And then sort of bouncing on that, I'll take a different perspective and look at the same questions from the point of view of a local gauge theory. But then the third thing I want to do is explain a little bit more subtle point of how the gauge and general relativity correspondences can emerge, how we could get CSPs that actually interact in a manner suggestive of the same long-range forces that we've actually seen in nature. And then talk about ways of testing this possible physics as distinct from ordinary gauge theories and gravities, and in particular some of the thermodynamic issues and how they're resolved, and what kinds of signals, the small modifications to thermodynamics that we actually see could lead to for non-zero rho. So I'll start with the spin that we know. So we all know how to describe spin of a massive particle. It's a tool to describe the action of rotations on a state. And different kinds of particles are classified by an invariant J squared. In the massless case, we usually talk about spin in terms of helicity, just one rotation generator, not three, the rotation about the three momentum direction of motion of the particle, And its eigenvalue, j dot p, is usually taken to be invariant. Now, as I've said things that are very standard and universally known to apply in relativistic theories, I hope you're just the least bit puzzled by how many three vectors I've put on the slide, how many three vectors we always use in describing our relativistic theories. The generators depend on reference frame. It's a bit curious, by the way, that there seem to be more generators in the massive case than the massless one. And even the invariants that classify different types of particles are written here in terms of operators that don't look very Lorentz invariant at all. It's not hard to take the massive case and make it look more covariant. And in the process, we'll see that really this sort of simpler version of helicity, it's no accident that it's simpler. It's actually just a special case. So let's consider a massive particle and just ask what's special about the rotation. Why do we classify massive particles in Lorentz invariant theories based on how they transform under rotations rather than under the whole Lorentz group? After all, a boost will also transform the spin degrees of freedom of a particle. But what's special about rotations is that they only transform the spin degrees of freedom of a particle. In particular, they preserve its rest frame, right? They don't change the time direction. That means that for a particle at rest, the action of the rotation is only on the spin degree of freedom. And so the action of rotations on that spin degree of freedom should form a representation of the rotation group. And then we can classify those. Well, this immediately suggests a generalization to relativistic massive particles. Instead of preserving the rest frame, we just want to preserve whatever the particle's momentum may be. So we'll consider the so-called little group, the set of Lorentz transformations that preserve a particle's momentum. And it turns out that we can describe those in terms of being generated by the different components of the Pauli-Lebansky spin vector, W mu. Now, this might surprise you. I've just replaced three rotation generators that keep a preserve a particle's rest frame with a four vector worth of generators that I now say preserve its momentum. So this seems discontinuous as well. But if you look at the form of W, you'll notice that it's by construction orthogonal to the particle's momentum. So that means really there are only three independent components in W, just as there were in the rotations. So three rotations, we're just now describing them in terms of an arbitrary boost in momentum for the particle. And we can describe the invariant now in terms of a Lorentz invariant scalar, W squared. This is pretty much equivalent. You can easily see that it's equivalent to the standard treatment when you restrict the momentum being purely in the time direction for a particle at rest. But you'll notice that in the process of defining W, J doesn't have any scale, any mass dimension, at least in units where h bar and c are 1. W mu has mass dimension because it's proportional to momentum. And so that means that this invariant that's replaced the spin is characterized by a new scale. Call that scale rho. And it has a physical significance, not surprisingly, since I had to covariantize the theory to get it. You shouldn't be surprised to learn that it has no significance in the non-relativistic limit, but it has a significance entirely associated with boost symmetry. So let's consider an energetic particle whose spin is aligned with its three momentum. Now, this is a three-vector alignment, but the four vectors actually have to be misaligned because, after all, the spin vector and the momentum are orthogonal. So if we look in a boosted frame, that time component misalignment is going to translate into a spatial misalignment of the two vectors in the boosted coordinates. Now the spin is not aligned with the momentum. So in terms of states, this says that a quantum state that starts out in a spin eigenstate for the direction spin component aligned with the momentum, a boosted observer would describe the exact same state in terms of a superposition of spins. And the coefficient of that mixing is parametrized by rho, the scale associated with the spin scale associated with the relativistic spin invariant. So this is a general lesson that'll hold in the massless case too. The non-invariance of helicity eigenstates under boosts is parametrized by W squared, this new parameter rho. Now, if we want the spin vector to be orthogonal to the momentum for a time-like momentum in the massive case, it had better be that the spin vector is space-like. In the massless case, we can continue that. For any given null vector, there are still plenty of space-like vectors orthogonal to that. So that might seem like the most generic generalization to massless spin of the massive case. But there is a degenerate possibility that because the momentum is null, we could instead consider spin vectors, states whose spin vector is totally aligned with the direction of motion of the particle. Upon quantization, this first case, the simple generalization, will actually give rise to continuous spin particles. And this degenerate case of a completely aligned spin vector and momentum will give rise to helicity. So this is why we saw helicity described by only one component, one degree of freedom, one generator. Because we're assuming by construction that we're just projecting onto that one-dimensional space of spin vectors and then quantizing that. So let's look at the general case. As for massive particles, there's three independent components of W mu that describe momentum, correspond to momentum-preserving Lorentz generators. One of these is the helicity rotation about the direction of motion. That's the most familiar one. The other two are less familiar, but they involve a boost transverse to the direction of motion and a compensating rotation. Let's start from the familiar operator, diagonalize that, and we'll work with integer and half-integer helicity eigenstates because that's what the global topology of the Lorentz group tells us to do. How do the other operators act? Well, they can be grouped based on just the group theory of how these different operators commute with one another. They can be grouped into raising and lowering operators, just like we can with massive particles with the transverse components of spin. So they take a helicity H particle and map it to some coefficient times a helicity H plus 1 particle. This means that in any theory with a helicity 0 particle, in general, these raising and lowering operators will mix it with all integer helicities. So in other words, Lorentz transformations mix a helicity 0 particle with all other integer helicities. Mix a helicity 1/2 particle with all half-integer helicities. So if you have one integer helicity in your theory, you have to have them all. And importantly, this coefficient is independent of helicity. So unlike the massive case, the series doesn't truncate at some maximum s. We really keep going to all infinitely high helicities. And the coefficient has units of momentum, and it precisely corresponds to this spin, invariant spin scale rho. So let me just summarize what kinds of spin we can consider based on these considerations in four dimensions. So any given type of particle can be thought of as living at a point on this plane, okay? Characterized by the two invariants, its mass, and the spin scale rho. Not every point is allowed. So for massive particles, we have a discretum of possible spins. And then each one of those defines a line on this plane where consistent particles can live. I'm just drawing the integer spin representations, the half-integer ones are analogous. In the mass goes to zero limit, there is a sort of integer spin version of continuous spin particles corresponding with any point along this horizontal axis corresponds to a single particle type with an infinite tower of helicity states. And in the limit that rho goes to zero, these helicity states stop mixing with one another. So then and only then we can try to build a theory involving only helicity one or only helicity zero. Now, this construction that I've shown you is in detail specific to four dimensions. But the basic notion of CSPs generalizes to higher and lower dimensions. In higher dimensions, just like the spin S representations get a little bigger and have more invariance, the continuous spin representations also get bigger and have more invariance, but they still exist in higher dimensions. In lower dimensions, the little group gets smaller, and the representations get smaller. In fact, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, it's kind of an interesting case because the little group is one-dimensional. This means that all the different particle types should have just one state that transforms by rephasing under whatever the little group generator is. So this gives us anions for massive particles with an arbitrary rephasing under rotations. Gives us continuous spin particles with just one state in 2 plus 1 dimensions. That state rephases under boost plus rotations. And then the helicity case is also simpler. There's just massless particles that don't transform under the little group. OK, this is probably the most technical part of the talk. I'm done with that. I hope I've shown you that generalizing spin to massless particles naturally gives us CSPs. And fixed helicity shows up as a degenerate special case. From that perspective, it's quite surprising that nature seems to make use of this degenerate case, particles with a fixed boost invariant helicity, rather than the continuous spin one. Now again, this same picture of the menu may give us a good way of understanding that. After all, we've already seen that there are kinds of particles that are consistent as free particles, like say helicity 3, flat space, but are not consistent in a full interacting theory. And that in other cases, consistency of interactions imposes some interesting constraints, not just on the particles themselves, but on the whole rest of the theory that they interact with. So we can ask exactly the same question about continuous spin particles. What does Lorentz invariance say about their consistent interactions? And I want to look at that first from the point of view of these soft emission processes, where you'll see the first example of this correspondence, where at high energies, these amplitudes look just like an interacting scalar. And then talk very briefly and almost impressionistically about a local gauge theory, because this is really a technical enough topic that it's best left for another talk. So I'll just remind you of the basic argument of how quantum mechanics and relativity set constraints on interactions one more time. Whenever we talk about emission of a soft particle, now I'll be talking about the helicity H component of a CSP. The emission amplitude can be described in terms of an overall prefactor times the sum over incoming and outgoing states of nearly on-shell propagators times these things called soft factors. Lorentz covariance tells us that this amplitude has to transform in the same way as a product of single particle states. That means specifically, for this case, that the soft factors have to transform exactly the same way as just the helicity H state under the little group. So how can we build a soft factor that transforms under the little group in this peculiar way, different helicities both rotating and mixing into each other under the other two generators? What's tricky about this is that the soft factor has to encode that with very limited information, right? It only knows about the momentum of one matter leg at a time, one matter particle at a time, and the momentum of the CSP. Okay, but this is still essentially a math problem. And so a good way to solve it is by reducing it to a combination of simpler and more standard math problems. So I'll just state some results about these continuous spin representations. They're just simple group theory results. You can think of the massless little group as being translations and a rotation on a two-dimensional plane, or a translation and rephasing on a complex plane. In terms of that parametrization, it's very easy to write down functions that transform like CSP states. They're just proportional to Bessel functions of the magnitude of the vector on the z-plane. Now, the appearance of a Bessel function here shouldn't really surprise you, because this is precisely a problem of trying to find rotationally symmetric solutions to an essentially planar symmetric problem. And Bessel functions always come out of that kind of mathematics. So now, if instead of trying to find a soft factor that transforms like a CSP, all we need to do is find a z built out of the momenta that transforms appropriately under these little group transformations, that transforms, that translates or rephases. And there's only one such combination that turns out to be available to us. It's built out of those two momenta. And you'll notice that this also depends on what looks like a polarization tensor, epsilon plus. So it's not a polarization tensor here. What the epsilon plus is really doing is telling us the orientation of the axis with respect to which this helicity H is defined. Let me explain what that means by a simple analogy. When we're talking about an amplitude for producing a particle, a massive spin 1/2 particle, in its spin up state, I'd better tell you first what I mean by up. I'd better tell you the orientation of that spin axis. And this epsilon plus plays exactly the same role for correctly orienting the helicity axis. You can only define the amplitude once you've specified what you mean by helicity. Having done that, there's this unique choice of z that transforms correctly and a unique covariant soft factor. It's just built out of Bessel functions of that z. Now, armed with this soft factor, we can start asking the physical questions. Does this amplitude make any sense? Does it lead to finite probabilities? And But first, let me just build a simple example. Okay, so I'll think about four scalars for concreteness, four scalars that have some self-interaction. So you have 2-to-2 scattering, and only the outgoing scalars are going to interact with the CSP. So that means that there's a 2-scalar to 2-scalar plus CSP amplitude, and we can write it in terms of this overall coupling lambda times the term where the CSP is radiated off the leg I've drawn in purple. That just has a propagator and a soft factor. And another term where it's radiated off the leg drawn in green, also propagator times a soft factor. Now, as we look at this amplitude, we ask, for example, what is the emission cross-section when we sum over all the helicities? It actually looks a bit like a miracle on this basis, that there's a Bessel summation identity that says, actually, it collapses to this finite form. Okay, the first two terms are just a coefficient squared over a propagator squared. Those actually look exactly like the amplitude squared terms, the non-interference terms, in a scalar theory. The third term does look a little different. It still depends on the z's. But it's a J0 of a real value, so it's still just bounded between 0 and 1 in magnitude. By the way, there's another basis where we just describe these helicities and basically go to Fourier space. So instead of talking about discrete helicities, we can talk about an angle on a circle parametrizing the states. In that basis, it's the amplitudes, instead of being written as a sum over helicities, become an integral over that angle. And that makes trivial both the fact that this will be finite, because it's just an integral of a bounded function over phi, over a bounded interval, and that these terms should be independent of the z's, because they're just integrals of phases mod squared. The mod squared of a phase is always 1. So they're finite, but I also noted this resemblance of the first two terms to scalar to a scalar cross-section. And in fact, in the limit that these z's get small enough, the third term would also approach a scalar, the interference term of a scalar amplitude, because J0 of a small number is well approximated by 1. So in the limit of small z, we see this correspondence that actually the amplitudes in a CSP theory would look very much like the amplitudes in a scalar theory. What is z anyway? Now it makes sense to take this. It started out as just a formal object that transformed correctly. But since we're getting interesting physics in the small z limit, let's look at what it actually means physically. So we can consider just breaking things down into components, assuming a reasonably large angle between the CSP emission and the matter momentum for simplicity. And in this case, the magnitude of z is just set by the velocity of the matter in the lab frame divided by the energy of the CSP in that same frame. So in other words, the small rho z limit, where we see this amplitude approaching, the cross-section approaching a scalar theory's cross-section, is the limit of high-energy radiation compared to rho, or the limit of radiation energies comparable to rho but sufficiently non-relativistic emitters. And in this regime, so I've just focused on the case of a relativistic emitter here, we can see how the amplitudes for the individual helicity modes also simplify at high energies. The helicity zero amplitude, not just the probability, approaches that of a scalar theory at high energies. The non-zero helicity amplitudes get parametrically suppressed. And you can see the top half of the Taylor expansion of a Bessel function here, showing that actually it goes like rho over energy to the 2h power for the helicity h modes for positive h. Now, let's turn that a little bit away from the sort of from plots of amplitudes, make it a little more concrete by thinking about just a cartoon model of antenna emission and absorption, where I'm going to completely ignore all of the internal motion that actually makes an antenna work, and just use an antenna as a sort of model for single particle emission and absorption. Okay, so we have an emitter and a detector, and all I'm going to consider is the absolute motion of the detector relative to the lab frame, nothing happening inside of the detector. Well, because they're both at rest, each one is really coupling like rho times, like z equals zero, right, in this low velocity limit, which means that the physics is essentially indistinguishable from that of a scalar. The emitter emits only a helicity zero mode. The detector emits only a helicity zero mode. And in this limit, the absorbed power looks exactly like it would in a scalar theory. So there's no way you'd know from doing this experiment whether rho is zero or non-zero. Now let's consider a boosted theorist, or let's just boost the, we'd like to stay comfortable in our seats, so let's boost the experiment instead. And consider the emitting antenna and the detector both moving in tandem relative to us. Of course, I haven't changed anything Lorentz invariant about the system itself. So the power detected and emitted, the power detected will still be the same as in a scalar theory. But now the lab frame theorist would describe it differently. The lab frame theorist would say, ah, that's not a helicity zero mode that you're emitting. It's some linear combination of helicity zero with a small amount of helicity one mixed in, even smaller amounts of helicity two, and so on. But since you're detecting exactly the same mode, the overlap is still one. In fact, by doing this experiment, we wouldn't learn anything about whether rho is zero or non-zero either. We could describe it with any rho that we wanted, and we'd get the same answer. But now let's take a more interesting case, where, say, the emitter is moving in the lab frame, but the absorber is static. Only in this case of relative motion between the emitter and the absorber do we start to see physical effects. So the absorber is sensitive to the power is at rest. So it's sensitive to the power emitted in the helicity zero mode. But the emitter is producing a linear combination of helicities. Some of the power will leak into the helicity plus and minus one modes. And that means the helicity zero emission and the power detected by the static detector will be suppressed by some amount of order rho times the velocity of the emitter divided by the typical energy or the frequency of that radiation. So by doing this experiment at different frequencies, at different velocities, one should see a qualitative and predicted velocity and frequency dependence in the effect, and one could extract a value of rho. This is, again, quite idealized. It's far more complicated with realistic antennas that do have internal structure. But I hope this gives the gist of roughly how the interactions work. This also sort of raises a very intriguing point about the kinds of force laws you might expect mediated by CSPs. After all, unitarity also relates the emission and absorption of a CSP by matter to CSP-mediated scattering. So if, in the case of emission and absorption, as we've just seen, it looks exactly like a scalar theory in the static limit with velocity-dependent corrections, you might suspect the same thing to be true of the CSP-mediated scattering, that the static force law is still exactly 1 over r squared, but with velocity-dependent corrections. And this is certainly consistent with unitarity. We've found an ansatz amplitude that does indeed demonstrate exactly this behavior. What we don't know yet is whether it's the only thing consistent with unitarity or whether there can be more subtle differences between the null and space-like CSP cases that might actually lead to velocity-independent corrections. So this is still open, but I think the possibility of the only corrections being velocity-dependent is actually very phenomenologically interesting because it's so different from what arises in other deformations of gravity or electromagnetism. So we've seen a series of sort of small miracles in the way these amplitudes behave. First of all, just the fact that Lorentz invariance and unitarity allow simple single emission amplitudes is, I think, quite surprising. We certainly expected that it would be a much shorter inquiry and that we'd be able to rule out these theories quickly on these grounds, but then we found solutions that worked. The resulting differential cross sections are finite, so it seems physically sensible. And at high energies, the helicity zero mode seems to dominate and behave very much like a standard scalar with rho equals zero. Higher point ansatz amplitudes display all of these features as well. And the finiteness of cross sections is something you can show from Lorentz invariance quite generally. So a little later in the talk, I'll explain how a small variation on the soft factor above could actually give rise to gauge and GR-like interactions at high energies instead of scalar-like ones. But I want to take a quick detour before that and just look at this kinematics and at the consistency of interactions and the correspondence from a different point of view, namely that of field theory. And a big part of the motivation for looking at this from a field theory point of view, at least for me, is that it's a good bridge between the quantum consistency arguments, unitarity of scattering amplitudes, small numbers of particles interacting, and the classical effects that we really want to understand, macroscopic force laws and radiation by macroscopic bodies, classical circuit systems, things like that. So it's very useful to that end to understand these classical effects, to try to build fields whose propagating degrees of freedom are CSPs, and to build up the kinds of interactions that those fields can have. But we immediately encounter a bit of a puzzle in trying to build a field theory. Because after all, we need to somehow encode in these fields every single helicity. Any finite rank tensor field with a finite number of degrees of freedom isn't going to be able to do it. So it seems like you need a tower of different tensor fields. Symmetric tensors are good enough, though. So you can take all these tensors and group them together by introducing a dummy variable, which I'll call eta, dummy 4 vector. And then you can contract all your free tensor indices into eta. This gives you now one master field that depends not just on x, but also on eta, has no explicit spin indices, but the spin transformation of the individual components is somehow encoded by the geometry in this eta space. I'll just show you impressionistically how this works. This is not a very familiar looking action, okay? But I hope it looks like a fairly simple one. It's just two simple quadratic terms. Let me just explain the different features of it first. So this delta prime just means that it's defined in the neighborhood of the null cone in this eta space. So not on the whole space. The value of the field further from the cone is irrelevant. These two terms in the action are actually gauge invariant. And in fact, the form is quite similar to QED. The first term has derivatives contracted into one another. It's analogous to one half of the Maxwell action. The second term has derivatives, spatial derivatives, contracted into eta derivatives, which amounts to contracting the spatial derivatives into the component fields like divergences. The physical degrees of freedom, when you actually separate out pure gauge degrees of freedom from the physical ones, live on a plane in eta space. And the geometry of that two-dimensional plane precisely realizes the little group. So this really does encode spin via geometry. In the case of kappa, this little parameter that I defined up here, being 0, it might be an interesting action for understanding some properties of higher spin fields, solving some technical problems in that area. For kappa non-zero, it's an action for CSPs. This particular action describes actually a continuum of different particle types instead of just one CSP with a single row. It describes all CSPs with every possible row. We think there's a closely related action that we're still trying to understand with just one CSP degree of freedom. If you project down to equations of motion for the different components, it starts to look a lot more familiar. In the row goes to zero limit, we just have a Klein-Gordon field, a Maxwell field, and so on. Free fields. There are order row corrections that mix each field with the higher rank ones. So mix the scalar with the divergence of the gauge field, the rank one field with the divergence of the rank two field, and so on at order row. And it's also easy to couple these to some background currents. So we can write down, if we imagine a current that satisfies an appropriate continuity condition, we can couple it both at the level of action. Yeah. Delta prime just means it's a derivative of the delta function, so it's only localizing you to the neighborhood of the null cone. But so you can think about it as the function and its derivative that goes off the cone are both degrees of freedom in the action, but higher derivatives are not. Okay? At the end of the day, once you gauge fix, there's only one function on a plane. But before gauge fixing, it looks like two functions on a space. Okay, so in the component equations of motion, the currents couple as you might expect. Now, I mentioned that the current has to satisfy some continuity conditions. And these are actually a sort of deformed version of the continuity conditions for ordinary gauge theories. So there's this tower of currents. And it starts from either a scalar current, a conserved vector current, like you could couple to electromagnetism, or a conserved tensor current. Higher rank currents also have to be present, but they're at order rho. They satisfy some conditions that suggest that they're order rho compared to whatever this initial. Order rho to the one or higher compared to these initiating currents, scalar, conserved vector, or conserved tensor. So this reinforces a lot of the points that I've suggested earlier based on amplitudes. Not only is there this, the propagation of CSPs consistent with Lorentz invariance, but we can describe it consistently in terms of locally interacting fields. And these interactions of such fields are compatible with Lorentz invariance and unitarity, both at the amplitude level and at the level of being able to write down consistent couplings to background currents in the gauge theory. We've also seen hints of correspondence already in the structure, the sort of rho-dependent perturbations to equations of motion that otherwise look a lot like a scalar theory, or a lot like a gauge theory, or a lot like general relativity coupling to TBNU. But there's an important question that I haven't addressed at all, which is whether there are matter couplings to CSPs, where the matter current conservation actually follows from its equations of motion, as it does when we have a consistent full energy momentum tensor in GR, or with a consistent electromagnetic current. This is still a work in progress. I think the existence of the matter emission amplitudes really suggests that currents of this form should exist, but we're still trying to understand exactly how they would work. And I want to stress that especially in the interacting case, this could be a very revealing clue towards the ultimate structure of a CSP theory if one exists. Because if you were to try the same kind of bottom-up construction that I showed you for non-abelian gauge fields or for helicity 2 interactions to give you GR, it's at this stage, trying to make the matter current conserved on the interacting equations of motion, that you would start to see the need for graviton or gluon self-interactions. So somehow, understanding the conservation on the matter equations of motion should be key to understanding any kind of nonlinear structure in these theories from the bottom up. But I want to come back to just this more basic point that I mentioned. There does seem to be a consistent interaction at the field theory level with either conserved vector or tensor currents. That hints at a gauge or gravity-like structure, which I haven't shown you yet in the amplitudes. So I want to move on and just explain how that gauge and gravity-like structure can arise in amplitudes, and then talk about actually testing the physics of non-zero rho. So I remind you how quantum mechanics and relativity together constrain the form of CSP interactions to an essentially unique form. Unitarity allows us to write down a CSP emission amplitude in terms of a sum of propagators times soft factors. And the soft factors themselves are constrained by Lorentz invariance to take this essentially unique form, a Bessel function of rho times this parameter z. And in the high energy limit, what that form led to, just by Taylor expanding the Bessel functions, nothing mysterious, is that the helicity zero mode interacts almost like a standard scalar field. The helicity non-zero modes have parametrically suppressed emission rates. But this is not the most general possibility. So let me just do a trivial change to the soft factor. I'm just going to multiply it by a Lorentz scalar product of momenta. It's a scalar. It's not going to change the symmetry argument I just gave you. So this should be consistent. The real question you should be asking is why we didn't consider this before. There's actually a good reason to not consider interactions like this, which is that this extra momentum dependence is going to lead to growing scattering amplitudes, which is scattering amplitudes that once integrated over phase space actually lead to growing cross sections. And so the high energy growth means of the amplitude of the resulting cross sections will eventually violate perturbative unitarity. I say eventually because if the coefficients qi were small enough, you could delay it a little bit above the scale rho. But for order one coefficients, this would actually happen right at an energy scale around rho. We'd get a cutoff of the theory. And so there is no high energy theory to speak of. Well, that growth can be averted by a special choice of the coefficients. Specifically, if these coefficients qi behave like a conserved charge, with the sum of incoming qis and the sum of outgoing qis canceling one another. In that case, the term of the amplitudes that would have been leading, which is just the constant piece of this j0, actually cancels between the different legs. Mathematically, it's exactly the same as the Weinberg cancellation, but the physical motivation is very different. So once that choice is made, it cuts off the growing, problematic growing part of the amplitude. It also changes the correspondence limit. At high energies, the helicity zero emission amplitude is now falling off rapidly, just like the helicity 2 and 3. But the helicity 0 amplitudes approach a gauge theory, gauge boson-like amplitude at high energy. One can do analogous constructions with a quadratic function of p dot k instead of just a linear one and get amplitudes where the helicity 1 and 0 are suppressed. Helicity 2 approaches a graviton amplitude at high energies. So these amplitudes really do fall into three distinct classes. Those that are dominated by helicity 0 with scalar-like interactions, that corresponds to the very simplest type of soft factor. Those with linear soft factors and conserved couplings, those approach helicity 1 interactions. Or those with a quadratic soft factor and universal couplings, in which case the helicity 2 mode dominates. And that's the end. There's no choice of a soft factor plus a condition on couplings where helicity 3 or higher could ever dominate the amplitudes at high energies. It's always helicity 0, 1, or 2. So in a sense, the same pattern of inevitable helicity 0, 1, or 2-like interactions that we saw for the rho equals 0 case continues to be true at non-zero rho. This obviously leads to the question of whether the photon or the graviton could consistently be CSPs. If you have p dot k cubed, you just have to put a cutoff scale in the denominator, and the interactions are either exceedingly weak or cut off at an exceedingly low scale. And there's no way to delay that cutoff scale to a parametrically larger energy by choosing a conservation law. Right, so all those polynomials are perfectly legitimate in some sense as effective theory interactions, but they're still scalar dominated. You're never getting anything helicity 3 dominated. Because the domination, even by helicity 1 in this case, was actually the result of two things. The linear coefficient, but also the suppression of, see, there was a part of the scalar amplitude that in this case, if I didn't have conserved charges, would have shot up even faster, right? And we need it in order to get helicity 1 to dominate. It must be the case that this helicity 0 interaction actually has some law that prevents it from growing faster that makes it cancel off. That's what the conservation of charge does. And there's no analysis. So you need two things. You need a momentum dependence, and you need a condition on the interactions in order to postpone the cutoff. When you do those two things, you get a helicity other than 0 to dominate at high energies. If you disregard it, I don't care about having a low energy cutoff. I'll put in arbitrarily, I set my cutoff, and I'll put in arbitrarily cutoff suppressed interactions in the theory. Well, then you could have p dot k cubed. But it would still be a scalar-dominated interaction that imposes a cutoff. So it's not really qualitatively giving you anything new. It's certainly not giving you helicity 3 dominance. The three cases that can dominate are the ones that look scalar gauge gravity-like. Still helicity 0 dominating. So anyway, we can discuss this further later. But the essential story is that these are the three conditions where you have a sort of defrayed cutoff. These are also the three conditions where you have a dominant helicity. It's always 0, 1, or 2. All the tricks you can play with higher derivative interactions are legitimate tricks in a theory with a cutoff, but they never lead to another helicity dominating. Okay, so what about the photon and graviton? I mean, of course, there's a theoretical aspect to this question, too, which is very important. Are there consistent full interacting theories of photon or graviton-like CSPs? But it also becomes an experimental question. Are the photon and graviton in nature helicity 1 and helicity 2? Or are they merely helicity 1-like and helicity 2-like particles with extremely small rho? Small enough that we wouldn't have seen it in obvious ways, like, you know, radio transmission. We might think about some possible tests of this, including, for example, radio transmission, modified radiation patterns, especially at long wavelengths, modifications to long-range force laws, and in particular, their velocity dependence. There might be some things, for example, atomic transitions that are helicity forbidden, but that could proceed faster through a CSP that might also set some constraints on rho. To some extent, these three, while clearly qualitatively interesting and important effects to think about, are really still limited by our theoretical understanding. But one of the questions we can answer most concretely that I want to spend some time on is how a CSP would change thermodynamics and how it wouldn't change thermodynamics in situations like the early universe and in very well-insulated thermal systems. And to give an indication of how this infinite tower of degrees of freedom could still be consistent. So the gist of the problem that you would worry about thermodynamically is that in a CSP theory, there's infinitely many degrees of freedom associated with each CSP compared to, say, 6 degrees of freedom associated with electrons and nucleons. Now, if there were a thermal equilibrium between the CSPs and the ordinary matter, that implies equipartition of energy, so that there's really an equal splitting of energy between the matter and each matter degree of freedom and each CSP. In other words, the thermodynamics of the system is totally dominated by the CSP once it reaches a full thermodynamic equilibrium. But the assumption underlying this picture is that all the CSP degrees of freedom thermalize on comparable and short time scales. We've already seen that that's not the case, especially at high energy. The high helicities interact parametrically weakly. The low helicities interact much more strongly. And so the picture that we should really have in mind is more like this. That if we consider, say, a photon that was really a CSP with some small rho, in a thermal equilibrium, and then we consider a thermal system of electrons and protons at a temperature that's large compared to rho, well, then we know that the electrons and protons couple significantly to the helicity 1 and minus 1 degrees of freedom of the CSP photon. Those modes will equilibrate rapidly. But the other modes have weaker interactions and parametrically longer equilibration times. In fact, enhanced by temperature over rho squared for the helicity 0 and 2 modes, and even higher powers for the higher helicity modes. So if we take this kind of system, we bring the bath of electrons and protons at a temperature T into contact with CSPs, and we ask, what does the phase space density of all the different CSP modes look like at late but finite times? So I'm just plotting the number density per unit energy for different CSP energies relative to the temperature. Helicity 1 equilibrates, so it'll approach a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Technically a Bose distribution, but let's assume that that's not relevant. The helicity 0 and 2 and the helicity 3 modes, however, because they're very weakly coupled, especially at high energies, they're essentially not populated. They only get populated at the very low energy tail of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So you might expect to see some interesting leakage out of a thermal system from populating these degrees of freedom. But you're not going to see a vast flow of energy away from the electrons and protons, as you might have expected. It's not behaving like it's coupled to an infinite heat capacity system. In fact, it looks like it's connecting to a system with 1 plus epsilon degrees of freedom, 1 from the helicity plus 1, and these, in terms of the energy and entropy density that they carry, summing up to far less than 1 degree of freedom in a time-dependent manner. But so we can ask concretely, for example, in the early universe, when electrons were approximately relativistic, very efficiently populating a thermal bath of photons, what is the condition from demanding that they would not efficiently thermalize a bath of the other helicity CSPs? And this merely requires that rho has to be less than about a millielectron volt. So still very microscopic scales. To probe rhos that are smaller than that, we need to look at much longer-lived, better-insulated systems. So what's a long-lived, well-insulated system? The sun might not be the first thing that comes to mind. After all, it's not well-insulated enough to stop it from radiating a lot of light towards us. But the sun's luminosity at 10 to the 34 ergs per second is actually 1 part in 10 to the 25 of the total sort of thermal Bremsstrahlung production being emitted and absorbed in its core. So we can think of the core of the sun as being insulated by the rest of the sun, which absorbs all of its photons, to 1 part in 10 to the 25. And we've measured this luminosity. It can be compared to the standard solar model, and it agrees pretty well. So that even a deviation on the neighborhood of 10% from that luminosity, if there were some 10% extra contribution of the luminosity that wasn't in visible light, that could change the evolution noticeably enough to be ruled out. Well, suppose that the photon is a CSP, and in the process of reming off and emitting and absorbing photons in the center of the sun, one out of every 10 to the 26 photons is actually replaced by one of these CSP partners of helicity 0 or 2. Because they're very weakly interacting, they're sort of wrong helicities, their absorption amplitudes are also extremely small. These could penetrate the sun and form an additional source of luminosity, similarly to the way that a light axion could form an additional invisible luminosity of the sun, which is constrained by these solar comparisons of stellar evolution to the solar model. And when you work out the associated constraint on rho, it's quite a bit smaller than the early universe one, around 10 to the minus 8 electron volts. In terms of rho inverse, the length scale associated with rho is something around 10 meters. And this is, I mean, this with cooler stars can give very slightly stronger bounds. But this kind of constraint is essentially the strongest, really robust constraint I know of on CSP photons. It sort of gives us a handle on where else we could look for experimental signals. You know, optical light experiments are not likely to be very useful because the wavelength, the frequency times rho inverse would be too small. But too large. But radio emission could have some interesting modifications if rho was on this scale. Macroscopic force laws could also very well be modified. So that's the thing to look for as far as a CSP photon and to try to understand. For the CSP graviton, the thermodynamics isn't a very relevant constraint. After all, even the ordinary helicity 2 graviton doesn't couple very much. But force law modifications should be a very tight constraint. And I think Hubble scale modifications to the force law could be particularly interesting. I also want to stress, as I alluded to earlier, that the physics is very different from, say, post-Newtonian parametrizations from giving the photon or graviton a mass. In particular, this importance of velocity dependence in the modifications to force laws and propagation is very distinctive. And so the limiting factor in searching for and constraining non-zero rho is really our theoretical understanding of how CSPs work. So to summarize, I hope I've shown you that the most generic generalization of spin to massless particles is actually a CSP. With helicity as a degenerate limit, a CSP has integer, in the case I've focused on, or half-integer helicity states that all mix under boosts, and the degree of mixing is characterized by scale rho. The interactions pass several consistency checks. There seem to be consistent amplitudes. They give finite cross-sections, viable thermodynamics, and they seem to be described by a local gauge theory as well. And moreover, the amplitudes hint at an intrinsic similarity to helicity 0, 1, and 2 physics in the high-energy limit. So before I close, I just want to go back to the question we started with. Is the structure of gauge interactions in general relativity really inevitable? Now, the rho equals 0 part, in light of these positive results, doesn't seem inevitable at all. There's a more generic possibility. It's not clearly at odds with consistency requirements or with data. So why wouldn't nature use rho not equal to 0? But the essential physics of gauge interactions in gravity, things like charge conservation and the universal coupling to gravity, these seem even more inevitable because the CSP physics, just like the rho equals zero physics, also seems to favor these as one of an essentially unique set of possible long distance dynamics, or sort of medium distance dynamics between the scale rho and Planck scale. So what do we make of this possibility of gauge interactions in gravity mediated by particles with rho not equal to zero? For one thing, I think it's very experimentally interesting, with striking similarities to familiar gauge and gravity theories at short distances, but testable differences, perhaps equally striking differences, at long distances. I also think it's worth emphasizing the theoretical ramifications of thinking about CSP generalizations to our helicity 1 and 2 theories. After all, gauge theory and gravity and general relativity are really integral to how we picture, how we think about symmetries, how we think about a dynamical space-time and the origin of gravitation. GR in particular completely changed the way that we think about space-time. In a way that it was, in a sense, although this isn't the way it was derived, inevitable when you start thinking about interacting helicity 2 particles. So it could be that the gauge and gravity-like interactions of CSPs are just some accident of low-order perturbation theory, that there aren't really any consistent theories there. And in this case, I think it's true and fair to say that actually our picture of the origin of symmetries and of dynamical space-time is inevitable, essentially, at least as a low-energy description, even though we all expect that it has to be modified somehow at high energies, where gravitational scattering, GR scattering, becomes inconsistent. But the possibility that helicity 1 and 2 theories could actually be replaced, could be consistent with an extension, say, of general relativity, where the helicity 2 graviton is replaced by a CSP. That kind of theory would likely cast our whole picture of space-time in a different light. And in that case, the question is, if space-time, as we usually conceive of it, is an approximation, what does it approximate? And I don't claim to have gotten anywhere beyond the very superficial surface of that question. But I hope that I've at least shown you some small steps towards sharpening and maybe answering some of these questions. And so thank you all very much.
So as usual, we'd like to give students the first chance.
Yeah, in a very shallow sense, this CSP is the tower of higher spin, or higher helicity. It looks like a higher spin theories. Is it possible to think of this as some sort of rho deformed? So in the limit of rho going to zero, you recover something like Vasiliev theory or something like that?
Right. So I think the structure of CSP interactions seems to be quite different from that of Vasiliev interactions, even though they both have a sort of what you're tempted to think of as an IR scale. The way it actually appears in amplitude seems to be quite different. On the other hand, there is absolutely a close connection between this kind of description and that of an infinite tower of spins, of massless high spins in flat space. So for example, this action here, when you convert it to Fourier space, is very closely related to the Fronsdell equations for massless high spins. So there's absolutely some interesting connection there. At present, I don't see any, it looks quite different from Vasiliev in particular, but there's definitely a lot to understand in that connection.
Next, any other student questions? Okay.
Another question. How about fermionic CSPs? Is that possible?
Yeah, they're certainly possible. So there you have all. I sort of sketched it out in one of the opening slides, and then didn't go much further. So there are fermionic CSPs with half integer spins, still integer spaced. Essentially, the same construction works. One can even group them together into a supersymmetric CSP. I haven't thought very much about the fermionic case or about the supersymmetric case because the real thing that I've been focused on is understanding the long-range forces. But that's another consistent possibility.
OK, let's throw it open to questions from everybody. I saw one up here somewhere, right?
Actually, I just follow this question about this fermionic CSP. I think if you assume the fundamental boson like gauge photon and graviton is CSP, and it's very natural to think about the matter fields like Fermi also have CSP, right? Because otherwise, it's easy to get this violation of conservation laws. But if Fermi has a CSP, I have kind of some concern because fermion, usually I think the minimal spin is like one half, so it cannot have minimal spin like zero because fermion have different representation on the time reversal symmetry. It's like,
yeah,
like
absolutely.
T squared so equal to minus one.
Just to be clear, sorry, I guess it's actually partly cut off on the screen, but the fermionic case would be a totally separate representation of just half integer spin, so one half, three halves, and up. Minus one half, minus three halves, and up. I'm not sure that you need to think of matter as being a CSP by any means in order to think of the force carriers as being CSPs. As I indicated, one can write down consistent interactions between ordinary, even massive matter with, you know, spin 1/2 or spin 0 and CSPs and CSP radiation. So that's not a problem. I don't want to think to speculate too far about Higgsing CSPs and giving them mass, because we don't even have the sort of unhigged phase field theory well understood yet. So I think that's a premature direction to say too much about. But yeah, just so the fermionic CSPs just have half integer spins. I don't think there's any conflict arising there. And it's not clear whether they're a reasonable version of matter to think about or not.
So I was going to ask about fermionic CSPs too, but I was beaten to it, so I'll ask about two other things. One is the graviton. I mean, does the binary pulsar give any emission, any constraints on rho for the graviton? And more generally, according to what you said, it looks like we live in a tiny rho world. So why don't we, I mean, maybe there's some symmetry that says we live in an exactly rho world, or another way of putting it, do we have a fine-tuning problem here analogous to the axion, right?
Right. So, well, okay, first I'll say that that numbers that could have been small by symmetry and are small, could have been zero by symmetry but aren't, are you know, all around us. We've got the cosmological constant despite that. I think actually, a small rho is probably a symmetric limit. And so in that sense, not a fine tuning. If you think, the way I like to think about it is that in the limit of zero rho, you have the symmetry to change the interactions or just to rephase each of the helicity states independently. In a theory with non-zero rho, they have to be sort of modified and rotated in tandem in order to maintain the symmetry, the Lorentz symmetry. So I think by that logic, small rho should be radiatively stable, should be a sort of limit of enhanced symmetry. Maybe there's some, you know, well, the most plausible reason that nature would choose zero rho rather than small non-zero rho is if the non-zero rho theories are just inconsistent. But if they are consistent with basic things like Lorentz invariance and quantum mechanics, then I'd say just like parity could have been conserved and wasn't, just like the cosmological constant could have been zero and doesn't seem to be. It's, you know, this is why I closed with this little slogan, that which is not inevitable is approximate. Obviously might not be approximate, but it certainly deserves consideration to try to understand why rho might be zero, non-zero rather than zero, and vice versa. I'll stop flipping. Right, but how many other things in nature can we ask that question about? I mean, I think the driving question here is whether the small rho theories are consistent, whether they offer new directions for experimental progress, and whether they could actually teach us something, even if nature does use helicity 2, for example, with rho equals 0. If a rho non-zero version of that theory could give us some insight into how to think about gravity, that would clearly be worthwhile whether nature chooses rho equals 0 or non-zero. And if nature can choose rho non-zero, I know where my bet's going to be. But, you know, we can all wait, see who wins the race.
So in the way we normally think about gauge theories, the quantization of electric charge is connected to the compactness of the gauge group. So is there some analog of that, or how does that come about in this point of view where you have a CSP photon?
I have no idea. I will say one thing, which is that there's a sense in which this field theory picture of a baseline conserved rank 1 current, you should really think of it as the same global symmetry. At least this is the way I think about it now. The same global symmetry that you would have in a gauge theory. You're just gauging it differently. Okay, so the compactness of that group is still just the compactness of the gauge group. It might not change at all.
Say that again. Which group are you?
The compactness of the symmetry group, the global version. You're taking the same global symmetry, a compact U1, for example, and gauging it differently. I can't put too much meat on those words until we understand the interacting field theories more, but that's the way, a way of summing up the way it seems to work. Same global symmetry, but instead of gauging it by just coupling it to a helicity one degree of freedom, you can also gauge the same symmetry by coupling it to a CSP.
So you introduce by hand the U1 somehow, and then
well, I don't know if you want to, I mean, if you want to take the point of view that the gauge boson somehow, the gauge interactions somehow introduce, you know, give you the gauge symmetry as something that comes out rather than as something you put in, then I think we still don't know what the analogous point of view would be for CSPs. If you view it, as I usually do, as something that comes out of the interactions, then, well, it's the same global symmetry coming out of the consistency conditions in either case.
Any other questions? Okay, let me get my answers.
So I guess what I was just thinking about is, I mean, your starting point was Lorentz symmetry, right? And the farthest, like the mean density of atoms in the universe is something like 1 in meter or less than that.
Right.
So, and I guess the limit that you put on rho was like 10 meters.
Yeah.
So I guess I would argue that that's kind of the farthest that you can push Lorentz symmetry, because we know that basically you cannot have vacuums that have better than, well, are empty on a scale of 10 meters. So I guess I'm not making a very hard point, but I guess my general point is that we know Lorentz symmetry is not symmetry of nature at in the low energies. And in a sense, like 10 meter is, well, depending on how you view it, conservatively is the scale of the Hubble. But I mean, if you want to be very cavalier, it's like I would say a few meters is basically where Lorentz symmetry cannot be trusted as a symmetry anymore.
Well, but I mean, it's spontaneously broken by the density of matter, right? You might worry that it's more explicitly broken by cosmology.
But the presence of matter is still
compatible with a Lorentz symmetry. It's just that the state is not Lorentz invariant. It transforms under Lorentz.
No, so but that's that a theoretical statement, I guess. Huh? That's a theoretical statement. I'm saying from observational point of view, Lorentz symmetry is a symmetry of nature on. You can build Lorentz invariant theories for everything, right?
Right.
You can make everything Lorentz invariant by introducing additional fields. But I'm saying from an observational point of view, the places where you take Lorentz symmetry seriously are basically scales that are microscopic. And when you get to meter scales, then, I mean, nature finds ways of breaking that symmetry, basically. Right. Yeah, anyway, so I'm not expecting necessarily a response.
No, I mean, I think the point is that as a structure of nature, Lorentz of the theory itself, not necessarily of the state of the universe, Lorentz symmetry seems to be, you know, very well tested. I'm not going to say it's sacrosanct or exact, because who knows, but it certainly seems worthwhile to, if we're going to limit our attention to theories that limit that respect Lorentz symmetry, that seems like. You know, and even with that restriction, there are still interesting possibilities that we haven't explored. That's saying, you know, that's a very narrow straitjacket that we've put ourselves in. What you're saying is, well, maybe it's an even narrower straitjacket than we have to. But if even within that straitjacket there are questions we don't understand, then those are very reasonable ones to focus on first.
It's a related question. Is there an analogous of CSPs for a cosmological constant background?
So you can ask about CSPs in De Sitter space. The way we think about spin is quite different in different maximally symmetric spaces. I don't think there's a simple generalization to a De Sitter background that's obvious in terms of a single sort of De Sitter propagating mode. But if there is a field theory, then there are very well-defined questions within the context of that field theory, right? Can you couple it? if there is something within that field theory that behaves like gravity, whether it's general relativity or not, and you can deform the asymptotic asymptotic symmetry group of the space-time, you know, either you can deform it or you can't, right? That's where the question is clearly well posed. But I don't have a sharp answer right now.
There's no analog of Wigner loopholes of representations that you know of.
As far as I know, there's no analog of this kind of the infinite dimensional representations in that regime. And what it's really coming from is the absence of translation symmetries, right? So Wigner starts from translations.
Okay, actually, I think I'm going to close the questions there. But, you know, Natalia lives here, so you hopefully can find her. So let's thank Natalia again.